Ego Po Classic Theater supports WHYY and presents the American Giants Festival, celebrating America's great female playwrights. Featuring three powerful classics, Lillian Hellman's 1934 drama, The Children's Hour, Claire Booth Luce's sizzling comedy, The Women, and Sophie Treadwell's expressionist masterpiece, Mock and All. All presented with dynamic new stagings. The festival kicks off October 7th. For tickets, egopo.org or 267-273-1414.
The top person in charge of overseeing Philadelphia elections is coming under fire for how often he shows up at work. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Several groups are pushing for proof that Anthony Clark is doing his job. WHYY's Tom McDonald starts off our show.
The public records request comes from government watchdog group the Committee of 70, Philadelphia 3.0, Fifth Square, and Philly Set Go. They've joined together asking for City Commissioner Anthony Clark's attendance records, his communication with staff and voters, as well as his day-to-day work activities. The move comes after news reports documenting how hard it is to find Clark at the City Commissioner's office. Committee of 70 CEO David Thornburg says a person who's supposed to promote and regulate voting needs to come to work to fulfill his mission.
We thought it was important to take the next step forward to try to document those work habits, because we're very distressed if, in fact, he isn't showing up to work and he isn't voting. So we thought a little more detail would help kind of drive the conversation forward.
The request faces two problems. One, by law, the city commissioners have 30 days to answer the request, which would be after the November 3rd election. Second, there's no specific number of hours a day or week the commissioners mandated to work. Thornburg concedes that despite raising a stink, he thinks Clark will be reelected.
The way this all plays out, there are no choices on election day anyway. There are three candidates in three positions.
Clark was not in his office and did not respond to email requests or phone calls asking for comment. I'm Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
Surprise, bordering on stunned. That describes the general reaction to yesterday's announcement regarding the imminent retirement of DuPont CEO and chairwoman Ellen Kullman. Joining me with perspective on the sudden change at the helm is Charles Elson, director of the Weinberg Center for Corporate Governance at the University of Delaware. Professor Elson, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
And good to be with you.
Take it back for us. Ellen Kullman was apparently an icon in the first state even before being named DuPont's first female chief executive in 2009. Tell us about her career spanning more than a quarter century with DuPont.
Well, she is a Wilmington native. She and her husband both started together at DuPont and both worked their way up. And it was nice to see someone who came from the state, grew up in the state, running the home state company.
Talk about some of the changes while she was at the helm.
The big problem with DuPont was it was a company that was an icon, an American icon, and their business shifted. When she arrived, it was in the middle of the question of where was it going. They had pharmaceuticals, which they had gotten rid of. There were certain special chemicals that they were in. It was a business that was a conglomeration of a lot of different lines of business that had grown up historically with the company. And as certain lines appeared to age, they attempted to expand into other areas. And it was really trying to figure out what it was going to do. It was also an old line company with old line cost structures. And that was a problem as, you know, the world moved forward. And she walked into a company that was in question, not survival, but in question as to where it was going to go. And she also walked in during the financial crisis, which put huge pressure on any sort of large-scale organization. It weathered the crisis, but it never quite figured out, at least to the satisfaction of the marketplace, as to what it was going to be. And according to Nelson Peltz, that's why he invested. Nelson Peltz is a very savvy investor who is tremendously respected in Wall Street. He has had great success in the other companies he's invested in and saw change. He came into DuPont and argued that DuPont was undervalued and that changes need to be made, both operationally and strategically. And his proposal was to basically split the company up into different segments, spin them off, and that his theory was that the parts were worth more than the whole. She, on the other hand, believed that the whole was worth more than the parts, though certain parts of the whole needed to go.
if I'm hearing you correctly, is it fair to make the assessment that Coleman then was on the losing end of the Peltz proxy war?
Yeah, she won, but she lost because she only won by, you know, basically 2%. It was 52-48. After that, she was under tremendous pressure. 48% of her holders, large holders, were not happy with the way things were going. And that meant she had pressure to deliver, given where obviously the stock price is now, or at least the market believed that she didn't deliver.
An interim has been named, and is it known whether that acting person at the helm will enact a new strategy?
Ed Breen was appointed acting CEO. Ed Breen had been head of Tyco. Tyco was a complete mess. And he sold off pieces, parts of it, re-engineered it, and turned it into quite a successful operation. Very talented, very respected.
To what extent will the change in players at the helm make a difference for the hundreds and thousands of employees of DuPont?
Well, it depends on the direction they take the company. If Breen decides that certain units need to be spun off or shed, it will have quite an impact. There will probably be some cutbacks. I think in the end, the question is, for everyone, will the company be a healthier entity when all this is done?
Professor, thanks for helping us make sense of this transition period.
You're welcome.
Charles Elson is director of the Weinberg Center for Corporate Governance at the University of Delaware. The Black Lives Matter movement has swept across U.S. cities, but as NewsWorks blogger Solomon Jones argues, recent mass shootings have proven that the call should extend to whites as well.
Last week in the mountains of Oregon, about 180 miles from Portland, a heavily armed gunman walked into classrooms at Umpqua Community College, killing 10 and injuring 7 before being killed by police. Chris Harper Mercer, 26, was in many ways a prototypical mass shooter. White, young, and male, he was a disaffected character who'd found himself on the fringe of both society and sanity. In published reports, neighbors described him as a man who was mostly quiet, except for the temper tantrums he threw in the apartment he shared with his mother. However, when I contemplate this and other mass shootings that have occurred in recent years, it isn't the shooter's behavior that strikes me as odd, it's our response. Because while the police killings of unarmed African Americans have shown that far too often black lives don't matter, the repeated mass shootings have revealed yet another sad truth. When it comes to the issue of gun control, white lives don't matter either. If white lives mattered, the slaughter of 12 mostly white people in a Colorado movie theater would have prompted a move toward gun control. So would the 2007 shooting that killed 30 at Virginia Tech, or the 2011 shooting that injured then-Congresswoman Gabby Giffords while killing 6 others in Tucson. If white lives mattered, the 2012 murders of 20 schoolchildren at Sandy Hook Elementary School would have prompted politicians to change our gun laws, but that was not to be. In the wake of Sandy Hook, bipartisan legislation that would have expanded background checks, banned assault weapons, and banned high-capacity gun magazines failed to pass. The defeat was widely viewed as the death knell for gun control in America, and sadly, that assessment may be right. The number of guns manufactured annually in America has nearly tripled in 3 decades, going from 3 million per year in 1986 to 8.5 million per year in 2012. The right to buy and sell those guns is protected by a gun lobby led by the National Rifle Association. Even in the face of mass killings, they argue that protecting Americans from guns will take more guns. Does anybody really believe that? President Obama asked at a press conference following the Oregon shootings. There is a gun for roughly every man, woman, and child in America, he said. So how can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer? The NRA has made that argument, however, and they've been successful in doing so. Therefore, we watch mass shootings and speak hollow words about safety. We see the names of victims and talk about the sanctity of life. We see a live TV news shooting and spout meaningless words about violence. In truth, none of these things are important enough to prompt change, because when it comes to gun control in America, neither black lives nor white lives matter. And that's the saddest truth of all. I'm Solomon Jones.
Solomon Jones writes the Philadelphia Experiment blog at newsworks.org. You can hear him weekday mornings at 7 on 900 AM WURD. Turning to this evening's headlines, police have arrested a 17-year-old believed to have pulled a gun on a student outside a Community College of Philadelphia building, prompting a campus lockdown and a large police response. Police Commissioner Charles Ramsey says the teen was arrested shortly before noon today at an adjoining educational facility at the college. There were no reports of shootings or injuries. Thousands of Pennsylvanians went online to register to vote or change their registrations in the first year of the new system. Yesterday marked the deadline for registering to vote in the November 3rd general election, and Secretary of State Pedro Cortez says more than 32,000 residents used the online system. More than 20,000 were new registrants. The rest, people who changed their information on their registration. Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf wants a half-point increase in the state's personal income tax and a new extraction tax on natural gas drilling, all in order to solve Pennsylvania's three-month-old budget impasse. The governor says the new funding will close the deficit and add about $400 million for basic education. 74 degrees, mostly clear skies on Independence Mall. It's 617. You're listening to Newsworks Tonight on WHYY. This evening's forecast, partly cloudy skies, low falling back to 58 degrees overnight. Partly sunny tomorrow, Wednesday's high approaching 80. Sunny again on Thursday, high in the low 70s. Still ahead, a Princeton researcher and MacArthur winner sheds light on day-to-day Jewish life in 10th century Egypt.
One of the sort of other surprises that popped up out of this material is the prevalence of takeout food.
Takeout food? All right, we'll place our order when Newsworks Tonight continues on WHYY.
Morristown Friends School proudly supports WHYY and is hosting an admissions open house on Sunday, October 18th at 2 p.m. Founded in 1785, Morristown Friends offers rigorous academics coupled with a spiritual and ethical education program for students in preschool through grade 12. More information about Morristown Friends, including videos and all open house dates, can be found online at mfriends.org. That's mfriends.org. Morristown Friends School.
Frederick Living supports WHYY. Frederick Living, a continuing care retirement community nestled in the beautiful countryside of Montgomery County, is proud to announce the expansion of their campus. The meadows at Frederick Living will consist of 55 cottages clustered in an innovative design based on the pocket neighborhood concept. Frederick Living is now taking reservations. Visits can be scheduled by calling 610-754-7878. That's 610-754-7878. Frederick Living. Live well.
Westchester University supports WHYY and is pleased to present An Evening with Dan Rather on Friday, November 6th. A recipient of the Edward R. Murrow Award for Lifetime Achievement, former CBS News anchor and 60 Minutes correspondent, Dan Rather has been a broadcast journalist for more than four decades. He'll share his experiences, his perspective, and his passion. Dan Rather at Westchester University. Tickets and information at wcupa.ticketleap.com.
Welcome back to Newsworks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. Perhaps less renowned than the Dead Sea Scrolls, the 300,000 manuscript fragments collectively known as the Cairo Geniza are nonetheless some of the oldest and most extensive records of Jewish life from long, long ago. Marina Rusto is a professor of Near Eastern Studies and History at Princeton University. Her efforts as director of the Princeton Geniza Lab have earned her a 2015 MacArthur Foundation Fellowship. Professor Rusto, thanks for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Congratulations on the fellowship, also known as the Genius Grant. So these manuscripts first came to light at the end of the 19th century. Geniza, apparently from the Hebrew word ganaz, to hide or set aside. What was being set aside in this Ben Ezra synagogue?
So there are a number of traditions connected with the sanctity of Hebrew script. Any text that could potentially bear the name of God written out in Hebrew, and probably this was extended to Hebrew script in general, can't just be casually discarded. It has to be somehow given a respectful burial. In most cases, manuscripts actually were buried in the ground, and there are cases of excavations that have turned up Hebrew manuscripts. In this particular case, when the Jewish community that prayed in this particular synagogue in medieval Cairo, built themselves a synagogue in the 11th century. They outfitted it with a gigantic chamber that could essentially be filled with manuscripts for 800 years and never need to be emptied.
Apparently, the information that comes from the Geniza spans a millennia, but you're focusing more narrowly on the Fatima Caliphate. What was its duration?
So the Fatimids conquered Egypt in 969. They went on to conquer Syria, by which I mean the entire Eastern Mediterranean littoral. And this, in a way, shifted the whole sort of economy of the region westward towards the Mediterranean, from Iraq to the Mediterranean.
Focus on how Jews were part of that economy.
Jews were a small minority of the population. They were a greater percentage of the urban population than the rural population. In Europe, it was much more common in this period to find Jews in the money trades, money lending especially. In the Islamic world, Jews had great diversity of professions within sort of the urban contexts.
What are some of the big surprises that have come to light so far?
So one of the biggest surprises to me is that people in the Geniza world only ate two meals a day. I wasn't expecting that. I had a feeling that they probably weren't eating much meat, and that turns out to be correct. Cheese was one of the most important sources of protein. Occasionally you'd have chicken, red meat, very, very rare. All that was to be expected, occasionally some Nile perch or something like that. But, you know, my assumption going in was that they're just like us. They kind of ate three meals a day, but that turned out not to be the case. And those differences for me are sort of a key to when I approach this material, I often find that I have to sort of give up my assumptions about what life was like in the past. When I was working on my first book, which is about the internal politics of the Jewish community, what really surprised me is what a low level of piety there was among the Jews. We kind of expect medieval people to be sort of pious and God-fearing and always adhering to the letter of the law. In fact, there was a lot of sort of wild stuff, a sort of fast and loose attitude towards religion among the people. If you didn't like your rabbi, you would change synagogue. You could even change denomination of Judaism, not because you believed something, but because you believed that your rabbi was kind of a nasty person.
Fascinating. Tell me more about the diets of those who lived during that time.
Well, this is one of the sort of other surprises that popped up out of this material is the prevalence of takeout food.
You mean like a Jewish deli?
Pretty much. Like Jews and Chinese food in New York, you know, same deal except in Cairo in the 11th century. What was surprising to me is how many mentions there are of people taking their little containers, either from metal or of terracotta, sort of layered containers with a
microwave safe. Right?
Yeah, of course. Layered containers with a handle on top to the market to get food from people who would cook in the marketplace stalls. And so on the one hand, that's quite charming if you think about sort of the, you know, the how common takeout food must have been in this period. But on the other hand, it makes perfect sense. The last place where you'd want to actually do your cooking is at home. It's way too dangerous to have an open fire. Even the bread baking, which is something that took place more commonly, would take place in the courtyard of the compound where you lived. You certainly didn't want fire inside. So it's another thing where, like, you don't expect it. And then when you think about it, it makes perfect sense.
Professor, thanks so much for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Marina Rusto is a professor of Near Eastern Studies and History at Princeton University and recipient of the 2015 MacArthur Foundation Fellowship. You can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org. Ever heard of a de-escalation room? WHYY's Katie Heiler visited one under construction in West Philadelphia to find out how it hopes to quell violence in one neighborhood.
Once a week, Rashida Ali Campbell visits a vacant lot at 675 North 41st Street in West Philadelphia. It's the future site of Earthship, a 100% sustainable building. Right now, the lot is home to more than 300 tires and 60 bags of recycled cans Campbell has collected. It looks like a dump. Even the new hand-carved wooden sign Campbell posted near the street has been tagged with graffiti.
Some kids wanted to write their name on there, but Marcus, he wanted to write his name on there. God bless Marcus. But yeah, that's our sign.
It's that kind of positivity that Campbell hopes will have an impact on the youth in this neighborhood, which has been plagued by drug and gang activity.
We found a great deal of heroin needles and, you know, drug bags, and we heard information from the police that there was a rape around the corner. So we knew the kind of neighborhood that we were in. However, it was perfect for me because our desire is to serve this type of community.
Campbell describes the escalating violence among Philly teens as having reached a crisis point. Her plan is to turn the Earthship into a community de-escalation room for troubled youth.
You know, the kids have a saying, they say, I can go from 0 to 100 real quick. Me and I get mad at a drop of a hat. It don't take much. And we're trying to teach the children that not only is that the fastest way into a grave, but there's ways you can de-escalate a situation so it doesn't even have to get to that point.
Campbell says teachers, parents, and police are quick to label these violent teens bad kids. But Campbell thinks they act out for far less sinister reasons, because of things like hunger, embarrassment, and stress. She knows this because she used to be one of those kids.
I was homeless. I was in foster care. People did not understand my home life. And so I hooked class. I was in the shelter. We missed breakfast. I'm embarrassed. I don't smell good. I'm embarrassed to come to class today.
Campbell envisioned a place where kids like her could go to get their physical and emotional needs met. A place with soothing music, fruits and vegetables, toiletries, even extra socks, and someone to talk to. She tried setting up these de-escalation rooms in 3 Philadelphia area schools, but quickly ran into funding troubles. Campbell had to figure out a way to make her program work on a very small budget. Enter the Earth Shift.
Take 2 bottles that are the same, and you get a wet saw, and you saw the bottles, saw those off, and then you tape them together to make a brick. And those bricks, you can create a beautiful stained glass window.
And the building will be constructed from inexpensive or recycled building materials and will be powered year-round by solar and wind energy. There will be an organic garden and a space for outdoor exercises, like Tai Chi. With any luck, Campbell says, construction on the building will be complete by next spring. But the real hurdle continues to be getting neighborhood residents on board with the project. Campbell is spreading the word about the Earthship with free giveaways, events, and community meetings. But the hardest part will be getting people to understand the principles behind the de-escalation room.
So we think about somebody do something wrong, you punish them and you hurt them. So if I ask you, well, consider now not hurting that person. I'm asking you to change your whole outlook on life. I'm asking you to have like a concept change and a perception change on life. And that is going to take time.
Campbell hopes to one day get back into the Philadelphia schools and see her de-escalation room program replicated across the city. But that doesn't mean she will abandon the Earthship.
This house is going to be here long after I'm gone.
For WHYY News, I'm Katie Heiler.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov and Kimberly Haas. Find us on iTunes or listen back to the show at newsworks.org. Tomorrow evening, we'll talk with longtime LGBT activist Mark Siegel, publisher of the Philadelphia Gay News. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.
New Jersey's Clean Energy Program proudly supports WHYY. New Jersey's Clean Energy Program, incentivizing businesses, local governments, schools, and residents to integrate energy-efficient and renewable technologies into their new construction projects, existing building upgrades, and new equipment installation. More information about modernizing in your home and business with support from New Jersey's Clean Energy Program at njcleanenergy.com/WHYY.
The National Constitution Center proudly supports WHYY and presents America's Town Hall, discussing all sides of timely constitutional issues. Tickets are available for Anne Marie Slaughter on Monday, October 19th at 6:30 p.m. Ms. Slaughter will discuss Unfinished Business, her new book on women in the workplace and gender equality. Ms. Slaughter's talk on October 19th will be moderated by Ronnie Polonesky of the Philadelphia Daily News. Tickets at constitutioncenter.org.